Welcome to The Lobbying Show, the show about the people of government relations, how they got into it, and what their jobs entail, what works and what doesn't. I am the host, Jim O'Brien. Well, it's Monday, and today we sit down with Eric Tenenblatt of Dentons, the largest law firm in the world. Eric is the chair of the Global Public Policy and Regulation Practice at Dentons, and they started a 50-state network of lobbyists, which is probably the first of its kind. One of the criticisms of lobbying firms and for companies that have to hire lobbying firms is they have to go and find a different firm in each state, and it can be somewhat of a difficult or time-consuming practice for companies that do that. So what Dentons has created is a 50-state network of lobbying firms in each state capital, and Eric heads up that group. Eric himself has had a very interesting political experience. He has worked for both Bush administrations. Prior to that, he worked for Senator Paul Coverdell, and prior to that, he was the chief of staff for Governor Sonny Perdue in Georgia, which is where Eric is based. He is based in Atlanta, but we met in the Dentons Washington, D.C. office, a beautiful building right on K Street, and we sat down and had a great discussion, which I hope you will enjoy. So here you have it. Here is Eric Tenenblatt from Dentons. All right, so before we talk about your role as the Global Chair of Public Policy and Regulation here at Dentons, and you're also the head of U.S. Public Policy, the U.S. Public Policy Correct. Practice. Yeah. You've worked for three presidents, U.S. Senator, Governor. I thought we'd just go back and start in, you know, where it all began, in Georgia, or where you grew up.
Okay, I'm pretty easy.
So where'd you grow up? Where'd you go to high school?
So I actually grew up in New York, out in eastern Long Island, went to high school in a town called Comac.
Okay.
And went to school in Atlanta at Emory University. Right. So that's what brought me to the South. Okay. And other than 4 years living in Washington, I've lived in Atlanta for the last 30-some-odd years now.
So you went to Washington to go to law school?
No. I went to Washington to work for President Bush. He just got elected president.
Okay.
So I actually did come up to Washington after I graduated Emory. I was going to do a joint JD-MPA program at American University. But it was right during the 1988 presidential election, and I worked for then Vice President Bush on his campaign in Georgia. Mm-hmm. And so I was up here, and it was the general election, and all my mind was focused on was the election because I had worked on the primary, and I just couldn't see myself sitting in class. So I withdrew from school and volunteered on the campaign. I think I had two other jobs here. And then when Bush got elected president, because I had worked on his primary campaign, I was offered a position in his administration. It was an entry-level job. And I ended up working at the Department of Health and Human Services doing legislative work, which taught me a whole lot. And then about a year later, the director of the Peace Corps, who used to be the Senate minority leader in the Georgia legislature, who I met when I was working on the Bush campaign, asked me if I would come over to the Peace Corps. So I had been at HHS for a year, and I was told early on when I got to Washington that people in politics jump around from job to job, and I should stay in a job for at least a year before moving. So I waited till the year mark. I then went over to the Peace Corps and did congressional and intergovernmental affairs. And I did that for about 2 years. And the director of the Peace Corps, whose name was Paul Coverdell, decided he was going to run for the U.S. Senate from Georgia. So I left Washington with him, was the political director for his U.S. Senate campaign. He got elected. I then worked for him in the U.S. Senate. I was his state director, so I was in Georgia. I'd go back and forth, but primarily I oversaw the operation in Georgia. And did that until 1996, And then I went and...
Can we stop there for a second?
Yeah, sure.
On the campaign, the only thing I remember from that campaign is Lee Atwater holding up that sign when Bush was going through a town or something. I guess someone... And this is just all innuendo. Barbara Bush was mad at Atwater, and so Atwater held up a sign saying, Atwater loves Bush, Vice President Bush. And I guess all was forgiven. But what were your two jobs, or what was your job on the Bush? Where were you working?
It was an interesting experience. So I had actually spent between my junior and senior year of college, I was participating in a program here in Washington. It's called the Fund for American Studies, and it was at Georgetown University. I took two classes, and I did an internship up here. And I got bit by the political bug. So when I went back to Atlanta to finish my senior year, I decided I wanted to get involved in the presidential race. So I volunteered for Bush. He was the candidate that I felt most aligned with. And I organized college campuses for Bush. So we had Bulldogs for Bush at the University of Georgia. We had Emory students for Bush. And there are about 12 schools in the state that we organized for Bush. And then in January, which was really my last semester at Emory, I had had enough credits to graduate because I had gone to school in the summer that I was able to accept a full-time job. And so I started out running telephone banks leading up to the Super Tuesday primary in March throughout the state for Bush. And then after Bush won the Super Tuesday primary, I went to the state Republican Party, still on the Bush payroll, and planned for the state Republican convention, which was in May, a week after I walked for graduation. So I graduated from Emory, went to the convention. And so...
So here you are, this 20-year-old kid running the phone banks for a future president.
Yeah, it was kind of neat. Yeah, and then spending time working on the Bush campaign and working for Coverdale, Senator Coverdale was very close to the Bush family. I left his office in 1996 and went and started a public affairs practice at a public relations firm in Atlanta. And then in 1998, 2 years later, Coverdale was running for re-election, so I was sort of a vice chair of his re-elect as a volunteer. And after he got re-elected, he was one of 10 people that served on the National Exploratory Committee for then-Governor George W. Bush's campaign for president. And so he asked me if I would chair George W.'s campaign in Georgia. So I did that. And when President Bush, George W. Bush, got elected is when I got recruited to come to one of the legacy firms, Long Aldridge and Norman, which preceded McKinnelong and Aldridge, which then became Denton's.
Okay.
And it was interesting because at the time, Long Aldridge and Norman was a predominantly Democratic Atlanta-based firm that had opened up a D.C. office when Bill Clinton got elected in 92. And they represented Georgia companies in Washington, D.C. And when Bush got elected, they had no nexus to the Bush administration. So the person who chaired Al Gore's campaign, who I was debating on television throughout that very long election and post-election debacle in Florida, we were very close friends. And he said to me, once it was settled that Bush was elected, he said, would you leave the firm that you're with and come join Long Aldridge? And I said, well, number one, why would you want a Republican? You're a Democratic firm. And I'm not a lawyer. I never made it through law school. And there are a lot of law firms, especially in Washington, D.C., that have non-lawyer professionals that are right, working there. So after talking with them for a while, I decided it was a good move for me to make. And so I joined the firm. I'd spend about 4 days a week up here in Washington, D.C., working out of their Washington office, even though my family was down in Atlanta. We had a firm apartment and continued to remain active in Republican politics in Georgia. And one of the co-chairs when I was chairing the Bush campaign was a state senator who was a Democrat that switched parties named Sonny Perdue. And so in an effort to sort of welcome him into the Republican Party, I named him a co-chair of the Bush campaign. So we got to know each other. And after Bush got elected, he said, I think I'm going to run for governor as a Republican. Would you support me? And so I agreed to support him. I helped raise him money. And lo and behold, he became the first Republican governor in 135 years. He got elected in 2002. And I went and worked on his transition, and he asked me to be his chief of staff. So had been up to Washington for about a year and a half, and then went back to Georgia, actually left the firm, joined his team, was his first chief of staff going through the first year he was in office. And then a year later came back to the firm, and then I've been here ever since. So I've been here about 17 years now. You know, when I first joined, it was just Atlanta and Washington. Then we expanded, and now we're the largest law firm in the world.
How many lawyers did you have when you first joined?
When I first joined, I would say we probably had 100, maybe 100, 150 between Atlanta and Washington, and then we merged with the McKenna and Cuneo firm, became McKenna, Long, and Aldridge, and I think we were up to about 300-400. Mm-hmm. And then we merged with Denton's, and we have a little over 1,000 in the United States, but we have 10,000 globally. So we now have 170 offices in 75 countries, 170 offices, continuing to grow. We're in all regions of the world. And in addition to leading the U.S. public policy practice, I also chair our global public policy and regulation practice. What we're looking to do is to expand what we're doing in the United States globally. Every country is different. So in some countries, law firms are not involved in the public policy space. Yep. In other countries, they are. But you know, we really focus on the intersection of business, government, and the law. And our clients are constantly having to deal with the government because of how regulated everything has become, not just in the United States, but globally.
What was the year as chief of staff like for Sonny? And what was Sonny like?
Yeah, so it was Sonny Perdue, who's now the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture,
right.
Was a terrific guy.
Was he an active governor? Or?
He was a very active governor. You know, he had been president. You know, think about it this way. He was in the Georgia State Senate, elected as a Democrat, got elected by his caucus to become the president pro tem, which is just under the lieutenant governor, as a Democrat. We had a sitting Democratic governor in 1998, and he switched parties because he felt the Democratic Party in Georgia was no longer aligned with where he was. It's a pretty bold move to step out of leadership to just become a rank-and-file Republican member in the state Senate. He's someone who is very data-driven, morally driven, very principled individual. It was an interesting experience working for him. People always ask me, was it fun? And I'm like, fun is not the way to describe it. One of the big issues that we were faced with is his predecessor changed the Georgia flag. And, you know, we had stars and bars. It was a very offensive flag to many people. And the previous governor pushed through the legislature a change to the Georgia flag. And you had a lot of people in the state that felt like they would have liked to get to express their view on what flag represented the state. And so Sonny, throughout the campaign, talked about how the people should have a voice in the process. Well, those that supported the previous governor thought that meant that he wanted to go back to the stars and bars, which was not ever his intention. And so the first year in office, one of the big issues we had was getting a constitutional amendment put on the ballot, passed by the legislature, to allow the voters of Georgia to pick their flag. And we had designed a flag. It was actually an old version of the Confederate battle flag that didn't have the stars and bars, which was so offensive. The new flag that the previous governor had changed it to, and the offensive flag. And it was the old Confederate flag that actually won out, and so that's the flag, that's the flag of Georgia right now. And he did it in a way that everyone felt like they had their voice. You'll always have people that will be upset with the outcome, but I don't think anyone blamed him. And then probably the other two big things I would say when I was his chief of staff is, because he was the first Republican governor in 135 years, we had to transition the entire government. So you had a lot of department and agency heads that had been there from one Democratic governor to another. And so we had to bring in a whole new team. And one of the first things he did was he asked every department and agency head to resign. They could reapply for their job. And he actually did keep a couple of department and agency heads that he had worked with when he was in the state legislature that he had a great deal of respect for and didn't think that they were very partisan. But we brought in a whole new team, and we also reorganized government. So we had the first CFO, first COO. It used to be that the chief of staff had all the department and agency heads report up to him or her. And the state is now, you know, we're one of the larger, we're in the top 10 now in terms of size of the states. And the government was just too big. And I don't know how anyone can be effective in a chief of staff's role if you have all of these department and agency heads. So what we did is we divided up the responsibilities and brought in, we actually had two retired bankers. So they came in from the private sector. One was our CFO, one was our COO. It was also a year after September 11th, 2001. So we created a Homeland Security Director. And we assembled a really good team. And Perdue was a very effective governor. At the time he got elected, we were in the aftermath of 9/11. We were going through a recession. We discovered probably about a $1.65 billion hole in our budget. And most state budgets require that you have a balanced budget, unlike right. Washington. Right. The Constitution requires it. So we had to make some tough decisions. We, you know, cutting $1 billion in spending. And so it was an interesting time. He also, right after he took office, after he got elected, he flipped four members of the state Senate that he was close to that were Democrats. And for the first time in 135 years, the Republicans took control of the state Senate. The House was still controlled by the Democrats. And 2 years later, the next election cycle after he got elected, he was able to flip the House. And so now in Georgia, both chambers of the legislature have supermajorities. Every state constitutional officer is Republican. Our entire congressional delegation, the two senators, we have four or five Democratic members of Congress, but all local officials, you know, the whole state. And I actually got a front row seat because when I got involved in 1988 in Georgia politics, everything was Democratic. The one Republican was Newt Gingrich, who was the only congressman from Republican Congress from Georgia. Only Republican. And now the entire state at the state level, and now the federal level is led by majority in terms of our congressional delegation. So it's been exciting to see. I've also noticed, too, that now the Republicans have been in power for about 15 years. You know, it doesn't necessarily matter which party's in power. The longer you stay in power, it becomes a little bit intoxicating. So some of the things I saw in the 90s that the Democrats would do, I now see the Republicans doing it in Georgia. And when we tape this here tonight, it's actually election night in Georgia for our runoffs. And we have a gubernatorial runoff and a lieutenant governor runoff. And it's our lieutenant governor versus our secretary of state for governor. Lieutenant governor raised $10 million, has been perceived as the front runner for the last 2 years. Was endorsed by the current sitting governor, Governor Deal, last Monday. And 2 days later, Donald Trump sent out a tweet endorsing our Secretary of State, Brian Kemp. And Brian Kemp shot up in the polls. And it looks like he's going to win tonight. And then our lieutenant governor race is between the Senate President Pro Tem, who's been around for 20 years in state politics, and this outsider, served in the young guy, former baseball player, was in the legislature for 2 years. On the primary night, the senator got 49% of the vote. He didn't get over 50, so forced it in a runoff. The second place finisher got 22%, and it looks like that second place finisher is actually could potentially win, which means you have these like two outsiders. I mean, even though the Secretary of State was in office, he wasn't the incumbent lieutenant governor. So it's an interesting time in politics. And I don't think Georgia's unique. I think you're seeing that all over the country.
Yeah, very interesting times.
Yeah.
So now you're based in Atlanta, but you spent a lot of time in Washington.
Yeah.
Is that
Yeah, I have an office here in Washington, D.C. Okay. I split my time between the two. We have about 80 people at Denton's in our public policy practice, and they're spread out. The largest presence is here in Washington. Okay. We have a solid presence in Atlanta. We have people in New York, Denver, and California. We have one person in Texas. And then we have our Denton's 50 network.
Right. So tell us about your job as the global chair and the head of the U.S. policy practice.
Yeah, so we have our public policy practice in the U.S. has about five areas, focus areas. We do here in Washington, D.C., federal advocacy, basically advocating on behalf of our clients with Congress, working with federal departments and agencies. We have state practices in Georgia.
The states that you mentioned,
yep. Yeah, the states that I mentioned. We have something called Denton's Local Government Solutions, which works with cities on a variety of governmental issues. We have two former mayors that are part of that group, the former mayor of Baltimore, Stephanie Rollins Blake, and the former mayor of Philadelphia, Michael Nutter. We do a lot of work in the smart cities area. And then we have an attorney's general practice. We have a number of staff people that worked for attorneys general. We have a cross-border practice with Canada. One of our large regions at Denton's is Canada, but we have a number of practitioners in the United States that represent Canadian companies in the United States. The former U.S. ambassador to Canada in the Clinton administration, Gordon Giffen, is a member of our team. His chief of staff is a member of our team. And then on the other side of the border, former Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper is part of our team. So we do a lot of work with Canada. It's an interesting time right now, given the trade negotiations with NAFTA.
Yep.
We also do a good bit of work in the area of economic development, working with companies that want to locate or relocate, also foreign direct investment, trade missions. Oh, and you know, when I was going through my list of states, I left out Hawaii, which last week, or 2 weeks ago, we merged in a firm. The Alston Hunt firm became part of Denton. So we now have a state government affairs practice in Hawaii with three practitioners that work with state and local government in Hawaii.
And then what you were alluding to earlier, where you don't have a state where you have an office, you do have this 50-state network.
Yes. So about 2 years ago, we created something called Denton's 50, which is a network where we have a presence in all 50 states. So in the states where we don't have our own people, we don't have Denton's offices, we went out and found the best and the brightest in every state capital to help us or help our clients where they have needs in those respective states, but also to provide those firms the resources of our law firm if there's a need that they have, not just on the public policy side, but even on the legal side. I mean, we have a political law practice that advises companies on campaign laws and lobbying laws. We have a government contracts practice that, you know, advises clients on government procurement. And of course, we have this global footprint. And Denton's 50 also allows us to take on multi-state engagements. So a lot of clients don't want to have to deal with multiple consultants or lobbyists in various states. They'd like to just go one place and then let someone manage that for them.
So a client can come to you and say, we're having an issue in Illinois, Kentucky, and Tennessee.
Correct.
And you can say, we'll manage that campaign for you, that practice. They'll report to us, and you'll only have to, you know, we'll oversee that.
Right. And there'll be times when the client needs to interface directly with the consultant on the ground. But we help identify the person, help negotiate any financial arrangement, and then help manage it. And the beauty of managing multi-state engagements is that there's no need to reinvent the wheel. You can share best practices because 9 out of 10 times someone's going to experience the same thing in one state versus another, or a company is. And,
right.
And so I think it's easier for everyone if you could just share, you know, what you've learned. And the other thing too, being a global firm, we have a lot of international clients that don't know the difference between a federal issue, a state issue, or a local issue in the United States. They just know we have some issue with the government. And so we need to be able to tell our partners globally that if you have any issue with the government, we can handle it. And so I need to be able to tell a partner of mine in Paris that if they have an issue in Connecticut, that just because we don't have a Denton's office in Connecticut, that we have a guy, we have someone that can handle your issue in Connecticut.
Right, you can call up and get the intel or whatever it may be.
Right.
So clearly you spend a lot of time on a plane. A typical week for Eric is where do you spend a lot of your time? Client development, administration?
Yeah, it varies. I mean, no 2 weeks are the same.
Uh-huh.
I will say that the most favorite thing for me to do is when I get to play strategist. I mean, that's what I like to do. I'm a public policy strategist, and at the end of the day, that's where my passion is. So I could do the practice management and go do the client development stuff, but I like really big hairy problems and helping, you know, companies try and figure them out that deal with the government, and working with my team to help them with business development. And I like to coach them and make them, you know, think a little bit outside the box. You know, we have a number of people in our practice group that have focused their efforts in one particular area. They either worked in state government or they worked in the federal government. I've been fortunate in that I've worked in government at all different levels. And so I understand the differences between the federal government, state government, local government. And there's different levers you can pull. And I've also have seen a lot. I guess the older you get, the more you've seen. So you kind of can come up with ways in which you can solve problems just based on your experiences.
Yeah. Now, you've also become a thought leader, I guess, on autonomous vehicles. You have a blog on that. How did that develop, or what's the latest?
I have always been fascinated with disruptive industries. And so one of the, for lack of a better word, products, or one of the things that I pitch to companies, typically it's investors, if they're investing in a startup company or a company that is going to disrupt an industry, is that they should hire us to do a risk assessment if it's a company that's going to operate in a regulated industry. And when I say a risk assessment, it's sort of assessing, what is that company going to face when they roll out their product? Are they going to bump up against an incumbent industry that's going to fight them? Are they going to bump up against tax issues, licensure issues? Who's the trade associations that are going to come after them? What media is going to follow them? And then identify all the risks and help them develop strategies of how to overcome it. Probably the best examples to use would be like ride sharing. So the ride sharing companies, whether it's Uber or Lyft, you know, I don't think they initially realized that the taxi industry was going to come after them. Or you could take a company like Tesla that developed this model to sell direct to consumers. And well, they didn't realize that the auto dealers would come after them because they want everything to go through an auto dealer. And even if you take it away from technology, you know, I view like the craft beer industry as another one. You know, in many states, you have these three-tiered systems where you have to buy alcohol through a wholesaler. Well, the craft beer industry, they want to sell direct to consumers. So I've always had this fascination with disruptive industries. And so through my work there, I tripped up on autonomous vehicles. And I was sort of fascinated looking at it and studying it. And I saw that, you know, I think we're going to move in that direction. One of the things I noticed was that the most expensive part of an electric vehicle has always been the batteries. But battery costs are declining significantly. And at some point, the cost of a battery is going to cross over where it's going to become cheaper to produce an electric vehicle than a combustible engine vehicle. And believe it or not, that is actually going to happen sometime in the next 2 to 3 years, which is why you're seeing all the large auto manufacturers rolling out these fleets of electric vehicles. And then the other thing that's happening is you're starting to see the technology that's used for autonomous vehicles decline in cost. And so what eventually will happen is I think you'll start seeing more electric vehicles over combustible engine vehicles. And then the technology for autonomous vehicles is not going to be cost prohibitive, that it's going to end up becoming cheaper for people to use autonomous vehicles in ride-sharing fleets. And this is very forward-thinking, but I think what's ultimately going to happen is, you know, I'd say 10 years from now, people are no longer going to own cars.
You're just going to walk outside.
You're going to have an app on your phone, and you're going to hit a ride-sharing app, and an autonomous vehicle is going to come pick you up. I mean, 95% of the time, our cars sit idle. They're either in your garage, in a parking lot, in a parking deck.
Right.
We're only using them. Right. And the other thing, too, a combustible engine vehicle has a lifespan of, 150 to 200,000 miles. A
lot of repairs.
Right. There's over 2,000 parts in a combustible engine vehicle. An electric vehicle has 18 parts. And an electric vehicle can go 500,000 to a million miles. Okay? So, and if you have an electric vehicle that can go that far without needing parts changed, and you have that on the road 95% of the time instead of sitting in a parking lot, think of what that's going to do to the need for parking lots. I mean, it's going to
create less vehicles.
Less vehicles. Safety. I mean, 80% plus accidents that happen today.
It's human error.
So if you get rid of that, what you'll have are cars talking to cars. You won't have people hitting the brake and causing accidents.
No
insurance
traffic.
Costs will go down. Yeah, the traffic will go down. And it's going to change. There's going to be some negatives for cities, too, because while there's positives in that there'll be more room for green space or economic development, there's a lot of cities that are very dependent on parking revenue. You know, in my home city of Atlanta, 40% of the revenue at Hartsfield-Jackson Airport comes from parking revenue. Well, if you have people that get in these autonomous fleet vehicles and they're not parking their car, they're going to have to come up with another way to, you know, right, generate revenue. So to answer your question, I just became obsessed with the area, with the whole space. And so we had a global partners meeting in Toronto a little over a year ago. And I posted that I was going to have a meeting. I was going to form a global autonomous vehicle working group for any partners. We have about 3,600 partners from around the globe. And so I posted it on this app that we had for the conference, and 50 people showed up. And I discovered that our firm is doing work all over the world in the autonomous vehicle space. So we're representing Baidu in China. We're representing Daimler in Germany. We have clients in Hungary. And so we had people from all over the globe. And so I said, you know what, this is incredible. I said, why don't we form a group? So we formed this group a little over a year ago. Every month we have a phone call. We share best practices. We share clients, you know, cross region. And I started a newsletter that now comes out. In fact, it came out today, called The Driverless Commute. And it's tracking trends and things that are happening in the autonomous vehicle space.
That's great. That's great. Well, it's a great business development tool that, you know, other people in the firm and other firms can think about. I mean, it's made you front and center on that issue.
Yeah, we were the first firm. I now noticed that there was another law firm. I was reading an article and I went to their website, and now they have an autonomous vehicle group. But we were we still are the only global law firm that has a dedicated group of folks that are focusing on the autonomous vehicle space. And it's something that, you know, we're going to all be hearing about. You know, going back to my whole comment about disruptive industries, technology is moving so quickly now. And, I gave a talk earlier today about autonomous vehicles, but I cited the fact that it took about 30 years for our parents or grandparents to embrace a refrigerator. Okay, in the early 90s, McKinsey came out with a study that said by the end of the decade, 900,000 people will use cell phones. Well, it ended up by the end of the decade, by 2000, there were over 100 million cell phones. So that just goes to show you how fast this stuff's happening when you disrupt an industry.
Yeah.
So when, you know, people hear me talk about how 10 years from now, people aren't going to own cars or they're going to, you know, ride in an autonomous vehicle, it's not that far-fetched.
No, no, it's not. Well, Eric, you've been in a all-day board meeting. We very much appreciate the time. We enjoyed it. A beautiful office here at 19th and K Street. You have to be on K Street if you're going to have a policy practice. Beautiful building. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Well, there you have it. Great guy, great interview, great firm. I enjoyed sitting down with Eric, and I hope you enjoyed it also. So have a great week. And we'll see you next Monday.